prison cell that I was in Vietnam was 8 feet long and 8 feet wide. I remember distinctly the dimensions of my little cell. I could pace 3 steps in one direction before I ran into a wall. Then I had the opportunity of turning around and pacing 3 steps the other way. Inside my new little home, I had nothing to do. I had no books to read, no window to look out, no TV, telephone, radio, didn't have a pencil or a piece of paper for 2,103 days. To give you a better feel for that window of time, 2,103 days equates to age 24 to age 30 in my life. It's a pretty good chunk of a guy's life. Now, I've been a very active person, like each of you. On the go all the time, type A behavior, searching for an extra 15 minutes a week to call my mom, and suddenly I had 24 hours a day for the next 6 years. I'm describing this scenario to you somewhat semi-dramatically, but I think the most value I can be to this congregation, the most value I can be in your life, personally and professionally, whether you're a student or a manager, a homemaker, whether you first of all consider yourself a wife and mother or a husband and citizen, the most value Charlie Plum can be in your life is to invite you into this little cell. I'd like to ask you for the next few moments to try your best to smell the stench of that 2-gallon bucket over there in the corner I call my toilet. I'd like you to try to feel the baking heat of a tropical summer in a tin roof prison cell 10,000 miles away from the good life. I'd like for you to try to taste the salt in the corners of your mouth from the sweat and the tears and the blood. Not that you'll ever be prisoners of war, God forbid, but if I do my job, you'll see where some of the same kinds of challenges you and I face every day. At the office, at home, with the customers, with the kids, the same challenges we face daily are the challenges that I face in that prison cell. And more importantly, your response to the challenge, if you're going to succeed at life, has to be the same recipe of responses I used over there just to survive. And who here has not, in the last few weeks or months, felt cut off from your support group? Unable to communicate with those you love the most. Inadequate for the new task, afraid of the future. So, once you get the hang of this, once you can vicariously put aside your comfort zone, once you can give up your nice car and your nice home and your network of friends and your title and all the material things that you take so much pride in, when you've given all of that up and stepped into this dingy little prison cell, when you have that feel, I have a couple of questions I want to ask. Here's the first one. How do you survive this? What kind of stuff do you have in your gut? What kind of tools do you have in your psychological toolbox you pull out and apply to this problem? Question number two. Since we're all part of the same family here, what about the guys next door? What about those prisoners that are clinging to life by their fingernails, but they don't trust you, they don't want to talk to you, and they think you have some kind of hidden agenda? How do you get through to them? Well, I don't mind telling you this. It didn't take me very many miles at 3 steps by 3 steps. I was going nuts. I finally decided, Charlie, if you're going to survive this, you're going to have to get a little creative. Come up with something to do. I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll make a little game to play. And I did. I constructed a little deck of playing cards about the size of postage stamps. I tore these cards from 52 little strips of toilet paper. And I can tell you this with authority. Toilet paper is tough to shuffle. You don't lick your fingers very much shuffling toilet paper. Okay, before we get back into the prison scene and the connection between my experience and our daily experiences, let me tell you how proud I am to be back in Milwaukee. I kind of started my career here, as a matter of fact. I was in the hospital, Great Lakes Naval Hospital down the road, and some of my first interactions with families and people were right here in your fair city. And I appreciate you coming out here on this chilly evening. given up some of your time and coming to listen to some of my philosophy, and I appreciate each one of you. And I think I can call each of you a parachute packer. Let me explain that to you. My wife and I sat down in a restaurant not so long ago, about two tables over. A guy kept looking at me. He stood up. He walked over to our table. He pointed his finger at me and he said, "You're Plum." I said, "Yes, sir, I'm Plum." He said, "But you're that guy. You flew jet fighters in Vietnam. You're a fighter pilot." I said, "That's right." He said, "Part of that Top Gun outfit shot down off the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk. You parachuted into enemy hands. You spent 6 years as a prisoner of war." Somewhat dumbfounded, I looked at this guy and I said, "How in the world did you know all that?" He chuckled and he smiled and he said, "Because I packed your parachute." He came up with just the proper words. The guy grabbed my arm and he said, "I guess it worked." I said, "Sure did, pal. And I must tell you, I've said a lot of prayers of thanks for your nimble fingers, but I didn't realize I'd have the opportunity of expressing my gratitude in person." He said, "Were all the panels there?" I said, "No, I must be honest with you, they weren't. Of the 18 panels I was supposed to have in that parachute, had only 15 good ones. Three of the panels were torn, but it wasn't your fault. It was mine. I ejected from that F-4 Phantom jet at 600 knots close to the ground. That's what tore the panels in the parachute. Wasn't the way you packed it." I said, "Let me ask you a question. Do you keep track of all the parachutes you pack? Do you know of all the lives you've saved?" Guy said, "No, now this is the most important part of the conversation." He said, "No, I don't keep track of all the parachutes I pack. It's enough gratification for me just to know that I've served." Here's a sailor in the bowels of an aircraft carrier. The guy stands there at a long wooden table and he weaves the shrouds and he folds the silks of these parachutes, passes them along one after another, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. Here's jet jockey. The Top Gun zooming around the sky could not have cared less about the guy down there in the hole. Until one day my parachute came along and he packed mine up for me. Question becomes, who packs your parachute? Who do you look to for strength in time of need? Maybe more importantly, who looks to you for that kind of parachute packing? Now, mine was pretty well packed when I was shot down over enemy territory. My physical parachute, 15 of 18 panels. My mental parachute, I had the skills of my craft. My emotional parachute, pretty stable guy. My spiritual parachute, I knew the Lord. I got my parachute packed, same place you did, early in life. Mom, Dad, big sister, two little brothers. I grew up in a tiny town in Kansas. Little bitty town, some 325 souls. I was a president of the Cardinal 4-H Club. I threw the newspaper. I was a Boy Scout in this little tiny town. And I got my parachute packed. And they were preachers and teachers and a coach. I'll never forget named Smith. If Clarence Smith were still alive, I would have called him this afternoon to thank that guy for packing my parachute. This is ragtag basketball. We lost and lost and lost. Last game of the season, we lost again. Here's one dejected 13-year-old lad sauntering off to the locker room and the coach coming up from behind. I felt his arm over my sweaty shoulder, and I looked at the coach, and he was a tough disciplinarian, and all I could think of to say was, "I'm sorry, coach, I guess this team's just a bunch of losers." And the coach squeezed my shoulder, and he sunk his fingernails into the flesh, and he said something I shall never forget. He said, "Son, whether you think you're a loser or whether you think you're a winner, you're right." I didn't understand that. I asked him the next day at school, "Coach, what did that mean?" He said, "Just this." He said, "Life is a choice. Every day of your life, you're going to have a beautiful choice." He said, "I don't care where you go. I don't care what kind of a scrape you get yourself into someday. You will have a choice. You can choose happiness or sadness. You can choose profit or loss. You can choose health or sickness. You can choose life or death." He said, "Now there's one more choice." He said, "You can choose to give away all those other choices. You can absolutely elect to step back and be the victim. You can choose to give away the hand you've been dealt. You can pass along your ticket. Let somebody else take your ride on the Ferris wheel of life, he said, but I don't want you coming back here in 4 or 5 years belly aching to me because you flunked out of school or because you couldn't keep that job or because you married that woman and she was beautiful at the wedding. He said, I'm not listening to that trash. He said, the truth is, the difference between success and failure in your life is not the things around you. It's the choices you make about the things around you, and you can choose success, and you can choose failure, and you can choose to give away the choice. Now, with that kind of inspiration and motivation, as you might suspect, I graduated from that little grade school top of my class of two. And the other guy wasn't all that bright. Well, I was 17 years old, and I needed an education. I knew I had to go to college, but I didn't have any money to do it. My father was a carpenter, and he couldn't afford to send me to school. And so I started looking around for scholarships. Now, picture this. Age 17, I'd never seen the ocean. I'd never ridden in an airplane. Certainly never seen a ship. Had no earthly idea. My father was 4F in World War II, and the closest relative I had in the military was a cousin in the Coast Guard. But I got an appointment to the Naval Academy. And so I got on the Greyhound bus in Kansas, and 2 days later, as many of you have done, I was raising my right hand and pledging to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I learned a lot at the boat school, learned to tie those knots and send the Morse code and drive the ships around the Chesapeake Bay. Lucky for me, I got my parachute packed. Officers and chaplains and other midshipmen and the superintendent who'd stand up in front of the pep rallies, and the guy would clench his fist. You could see the veins running his brow. He would say, you guys can do anything you set your minds to do. You guys can do anything you set your minds to do. Was this hype? Was he messing with our minds? Did it work? Those 4 years, the Naval Academy produced two Heisman Trophy winners, Roger Staubach, Joe Bellino. We were the number two, number one college team in the country for a while. Best of all, Navy beat Army 4 times straight. This guy was right. We could, in fact, do anything we set our minds to do. I would submit to you at this moment that both of those guys in my life, both the coach and the soup, empowered me. They gave me the power. They empowered me to win, which was beautiful. And more importantly, they empowered me to fail. And most important of all, they empowered me to make the choice between the two. Another very important part of my life, the Naval Academy, I was a member of the Officers Christian Union, OCU we called it. We got together in the basement of Bancroft Hall on every Wednesday evening and pretended to be chaplains. Because there aren't enough chaplains to go aboard every ship in the Navy. And so we were official lay leaders who could conduct services and that would stand up later on in my life just to know a little bit about organization and churches. Well, so with that kind of inspiration and motivation, I graduated from Annapolis. From there, I did not graduate top of my class. In fact, from the Naval Academy, I graduated in the half of the class that made the top half possible. This was a dirty job, but somebody had to do it. I tossed that hat in the air, pinned on those ends and bars, married my high school sweetheart, a lovely blonde lady from Kansas under the Arch of Swords. It was a military wedding, picture perfect. We went to flight training, Pensacola, Florida, Beeville, Texas, Meridian, Mississippi, out to San Diego, where I flew the first adversarial flights for the Top Gun school. Exciting times. And then I launched on the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk, a floating city, 5,000 men aboard this ship. And I waved goodbye to my wife, and I promised her I'd be back in 8 months. And I almost made it. Almost made it. I was 5 days from the end of my tour. 5 days from going home, 74 combat missions, over 100 carrier landings, pretty well-seasoned jet fighter pilot by this time, and 5 days to go. Well, let me tell you about that day. The day I was shot down? Maybe you've had a day like this. It started out nice enough. Puffy clouds, blue sky. See if you can identify with this. 24 years old. I am in command of a multi-million-dollar jet fighter. Look at his hand. I shove these two throttles into the afterburners. I can go 1,400 miles an hour. Now, that's a long way from a John Deere. I'll tell you that. Look at this pinky this thumb. I have enough firepower hanging from these wings with these two buttons on my control stick. I can release these weapons, and I can make a major hole in about any city in the world. I really am the top gun. I'm the best of the best. I'm the guy that always stands tall. I'm the one that's never afraid. Why? Well, I'm probably bulletproof. Ever feel bulletproof? Here's the point. It's okay to have positive attitudes. I totally believe in thinking positively. But when you start getting cocky, when you start believing that you can kick back and put your feet up on the desk, that you know all there is to know, and you can go for a little slack, when you start feeling bulletproof, check your 6 o'clock position. You got a missile sneaking up your tail. We were blown out of the sky. A SAM hit us. Blew up to some 12,000 pounds of jet fuel we had in that airplane and sent that bird topsy-turvy end over end down towards the rice paddy below. I ejected, my co-pilot ejected, our parachutes opened, and we came floating down over enemy territory. Ever been in one of those parachutes? But I don't mean the nylon ones. I'm talking about those parachutes of life. I'm talking about those gut-wrenchers you and I get ourselves into. I'm talking about something as insignificant as being cut out of your lane on the freeway, something as major as the loss of a loved one. Isn't that where it's at? Isn't that where your value lies? I mean, let's measure it. Let's measure your value to your God. Let's measure your value to yourself. Let's measure your value to your family. You see, it can't be measured in the easy times. Anybody can show up. Have you noticed that? Anybody can answer the phone. Your true value to yourself, to your team, to your family, to this church, to your God, shows up when the heat's on, when things are tough. Your value shows up when you're confused and you don't know the answer. Your value shows up when you want to quit and your boss wants you to quit. Or let's turn the coin over. What if you had the perfect life? What if you had 200% more money than you could ever spend and the time to spend it? And if you had happy, healthy families and wonderful relationships and got the feeling, now, would you be as alive? Would you be as proactive? Would you have as much fun? Would you even be at a meeting like this if you had no problems at all? Here's the point. There's great value in being blown out of the sky once in a while. That's a tough one to sell. Who wants it? You know, Charlie, do I have to go through that to learn this? Who wants it? And yet, if you and I had 5 minutes, I'll bet if we comb back through your life and you were truly honest with me when I asked the question, what's the most valuable experiences you've ever had? What gave you the most growth? That you'd also say those were some of the toughest experiences you had. Anybody know my pal Tom Sullivan? He's a speaker. I see a few heads nodding there. He's also a Hollywood actor. You see him in some movies, and he's a correspondent for ABC Good Morning America, and he's a concert pianist and a pretty good golfer. He was an Olympic wrestler, pretty good skier, and, as he would say, by the way, he's been blind since birth. Oh, he's a skydiver. I forgot that. This guy jumps out of perfectly good airplanes. Go figure. It must be tough on the CNI dog. No, come on. We went camping. Tom and I went camping. I'd known him, but not well, so we went camping. We canoed the rapids, climbed the sheer cliffs of the valleys. We decided that a lot of similarity between his growing up blind, my spending 6 years in a communist prison camping. Some of the challenges that we face personally and professionally in daily life. And here's where it begins. The first time you hear the guys down the block and they're throwing a ball against the bat, and the very first time you recognize, dude, you're blind and you're never going to play that game. And the very first time they run that bar through the door and into the bolt the other side, they put a big lock on it, they giggle away with the keys in some foreign language, and the very first time you recognize, Top Gun, you just lost your freedom. And maybe next is your life. And the very first time the little wrinkle in your plan, you know, when somebody didn't respond quite the way you wanted them to, Now, what's the same emotion? Oh, God, why me? This is terrible. What could be worse than this? This event will never have any value. And yet, you know what we decided on our camping trip? We decided his growing up blind, my spending 6 years in a communist prison camp was probably the best thing could have happened to us. You and I are who we are today because of the challenges we have faced, certainly not because of the job guarantees. You and I are who we are today because of those moments we've been blown out of the sky and the parachutes we have found to validate our value system. But if that's true, then how do you turn it around? How do you take advantage of this empowerment? How do you take the negative stuff that falls on you and make something positive from it? Tell you what I did. I felt the opening shock of the parachute. As I had been trained as a pilot, I looked up and I counted the panels in my parachute. That's called assessing your support group. I looked down at the unknown. They're shooting at me. The audacity of the enemy. Don't they know I'm the top gun? They've just knocked down my multi-million-dollar jet fighter, and now they're shooting at the pilot. And I'll tell you this, now you can identify with this one, when you're dodging bullets, it's tough to come up with a long-range plan. So what do you do? Tell you what I did. Same thing you would have done. Sat real still in the harness of that parachute. I mean, these bullets are whizzing by. Took a deep breath, let about half of it out, and I bowed my head, and I talked to my Lord. I asked him for a little extra strength that day. I looked back on that prayer many times, you know, and asking myself, while I was in the prison camp, well, why didn't you try to make a deal with God, you know? You know, promise him you go back through the ministry or be a good person the rest of your life. Pray for a great miracle wind to whisk you back out to sea or a couple of eagles to fly by and snag your parachutes and drop you both back on the ship. I didn't even think of that. I just prayed for the guts it was going to take to survive whatever challenge the Lord had in store for me. And I prayed for the strength of that wife I had left behind, that she would understand. And about that time, I hit the ground, sunk about waist deep in a rice paddy. I was descended upon by about a zillion of the enemy. They stripped me of everything I had. They took my flight gear, my clothing, my personal possessions. They even took my name. They gave me a name from their language just to humiliate me for the next 6 years. Dragged me around village to village, camp to camp, finally into Hanoi, where I was tortured for 2 days and tossed into this little cell. The one I described to you from the very beginning of our little chat, I wasn't kidding you an inch. Now, I was in several different cells while I was there. They moved us around about every 6 months. But the first cell and the average cell was 8 feet long and 8 feet wide. I was pacing along one day, about 200 miles into my experience. I heard in the far corner the chirping noise of a cricket. Just a little cricket sound there. I paid no attention at first. I'd had all varieties of bugs and snakes and rats in that cell. One more cricket didn't bother me. But the longer I listened, the more rhythmic that sound became. I thought, that's a pretty educated little critter. Maybe I can teach that dude to sing. I walked over to the corner and found no cricket at all, but a piece of wire was about that long. It was poked through a hole at the base of the cell wall and scratching on my concrete floor, making this chirping noise like a cricket. Are you with me now? Can you imagine what may be going through your mind? I'm watching the wire, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, somebody wants to network. Somebody wants to be on my team. Somebody wants to pack my parachute. Boy, do I need my parachute packed at this moment in my life. I'm losing track. I don't know what's a real memory anymore, what's a hallucination. I need a baseline. I need to validate my sanity. I need to tug on the wire. Now, what's the overriding emotion? Why didn't I tug on this wire at first? Hint, it's the same single four-letter word that debilitates us all. It debilitates us as parents, as citizens, as managers, as Christians. It's called fear. But maybe not the fear you'd suspect, because it wasn't the Rambo, blood, guts, wartime, life, death kind of fear.
The fear I was feeling at that moment is the same fear we all feel every day. When you approach the boss with that new idea or the spouse with that unspeakable topic, it's that old fear of inadequacy, that fear of failure, that fear that I'm not going to measure up. Here's what's going down. I'm thinking to myself, on the other end of that wire is another fighter pilot, like me. And I'd sure like to talk to another fighter pilot, but I'll bet that guy's tougher than I am. I'll bet he didn't cry when they tortured him like I did. I'm losing interest now. Ever have those feelings? It'd be nice, you know. It'd be nice to get on that church committee and see what I can do. It'd be nice to run for the school board. It'd be nice to get outside myself and take on something that I'm not sure that I can complete. But hey, life's pretty short. And I got other things to do. And if I can just hang on in this prison cell for another year or two, maybe I'll be set free and I won't have to take any more risks. Ever have those feelings? Guess we all do. We just want to cower away, and especially in the tough times, you know, we just want to turn our back on the problem and point our finger and hope that it disappears. But it doesn't work. It didn't work in the prison camp, and it doesn't work in daily life. The only security we have is our ability to make things happen, is to tug on wires. So I reached down and I grabbed the wire and I closed my eyes and gritted my teeth and I tugged, and the wire tugged back, and I tugged again. And the wire tugged back. And the third time I tugged, it disappeared. The wire came back about an hour later. Had a little note wrapped around the end of it. The note was written on a dirty piece of toilet paper, just blobs on this wadded up piece of toilet paper. I could barely make this out. But it said, memorize this code, then eat this note. I did it. I memorized the code, I ate the note, sneaked back to the hole in the wall, and I started tugging on that wire. Was I fortunate? On the other end of that little wire, Lieutenant Commander Bob Shoemaker, fighter pilot extraordinaire, astronaut candidate, but best of all, here's a parachute packer. Remember the definition? A guy who would give of himself, asking nothing in return, just out there serving for the sake of serving. He wasn't looking for a quick fix or immediate gratification or a kudo or accolade. He was just packing parachutes. He said, how you doing, buddy? I said, I'm doing terrible, buddy. I said, my president sent me over here. It's his dirty war, not mine. I did not start the Vietnam War. He did. It's not fair what's going on in my life, but it's not my fault, and I'm just the victim of circumstances beyond my control. And the enemy's not playing fair. They're torturing prisoners. They're not supposed to be doing that. This is not fair, what's going on in my life, but it's not my fault. And I'm just the victim of circumstances beyond my control. And it wasn't my private jet I flew in here, you know. That was a U.S. government airplane. Said so right on the tail. Said U.S. government right there. Congress bought it. I didn't. They should be here. I should not. This whole thing is not fair, what's going on in my life. I ever feel that way, but it's not my fault. And I'm just a victim of circumstances beyond my control. Shoemaker said, you want to know your biggest problem? I said, you mean I have problems bigger than the ones I can see? He said, sure sounds like it. Sounds like you're suffering from a fairly common prison disease. Some guys die from this disease. I said, I don't know what's the name of this disease. He said, around here we call it prison thinking. I said, prison thinking? He said, Roger, you think you're a prisoner. I'm thinking, what kind of nut did they put me next to? Look at this. I'm dressed in rags. I have four holes in my body where blood's running out. I have 27 boils on my front side, a bunch more on my back, all this jungle rot all over me. I'm down to 115 pounds. I'm rotting away in a communist prison camp, and now, to add insult to injury, they put me next to a positive thinker. I kept tugging. It was the only ball game in town. I said, okay, tell me about prison thinking. He said, don't you see? When a fighter pilot is first blown out of the sky, or when any of us go through a little wrinkle in the plan... What's the immediate emotion? Oh, God, why me? This is terrible. What could be worse than this? This event will never have any value. Emotion number two, hey, but it's not my fault. I mean, I'm not making these high-level decisions. I didn't start this war.
I'm just the victim of circumstances beyond my control. Emotion number three. Hey, it's not your fault. Got to be somebody's fault. Right, right. Blame everybody you can think of. Blame the president for sending you over here. Blame the enemy. They're not playing fair. Blame the Congress. They bought your airplane. The problem here, according to Shoemaker, is when you start blaming other people for your problems, you give away control of your life. That's what the coach was telling me years before. Remember the coach? Said I had the option to give away the option. Shoemaker says precisely how to do it. He said, then you're going to shower yourself with pity, get a big bushel, you'll need a lot. And the final stage of prison thinking, just before you die. Now that was comforting. He said, you'll find yourself, jump up on the stage and play the role, read the script. It's an easy script. It says prisoner of war at the top. All you got to do is get dirty, ugly, bearded, ragged, skinny, cuss a lot. Crawl up in a corner, wave your fist, damn your God, atrophy, die if you can. That's the definition of a prisoner of war. He said, I'll tell you this. You think of yourself as a prisoner of war, you play that role. You blame somebody else for your problems and thus give away your power. You deny that you have any control over your destiny, and you're going to die here. Cash in early. You're going to go home in a box if you're lucky. I said, okay, I guess I've got a bad case of this prison thinking. What's the antidote to my disease? He said, the first thing you need, old buddy, is faith. He said, I'm not a preacher. I'm not going to try to convert you to a religion. He said, I just got to tell you the facts. Facts are the guys that can tap into a source of strength and power greater than themselves are the guys that live. He said, you have to have faith in your community and faith in your country and faith in your flag and faith in your family and faith in yourself. He said, you got to be a believer. He said, you got to have commitment. Just have to be dog determined. Sometimes you just can't ask any questions. You just have to keep on keeping on around here. He said, sometimes we don't know any answers, so we just do it right because it's right. Hey, what a novel idea. Do it right because it's right. He said, you have to have courage. Sometimes you're stepping up to the plate. It's the bottom of the ninth, and you're 20 runs behind, and you still got to step up to the plate and look for that golden apple. He said, you have to have self-esteem. You got to believe you're a child of God, and it's going to be all right. And you have to have humor, he said. He said, every day you got to find something in this prison camp to laugh at, to smile at. I said, okay, I think I've got those things. He said, one more thing. I said, what? He says, it's our motto. I said, we got a motto? He said, yeah. The motto is four words. Keep the faith, baby. He said, in our church call around here is five coughs. I said, five coughs? He said, Roger. And he signed off. I'm thinking, church call is five coughs. Well, we had church call on the ship. That was Wednesday evening, Sunday morning, and they'd blow the bugle, and we'd all gather on the fantail of this aircraft carrier, and we would sing, and we would pray, and it was church call. But in a prison cell? And so my mind started to wander, and I thought, well, Sunday morning is going to come, and they're going to let me out of here, and I'm going to get together with all the other guys. We're going to go out in the some kind of a prison compound. We're going to have our Bibles and we'll have an altar. Maybe a little organ and we'll sing and pray. So I started to get ready. I went back through my mind. All of the hymns I'd ever sung. How many hymns do you think you could remember all the way through? 72. I came up with 72 different hymns that I could sing all the way through. I came up with all the Bible verses I'd learned as a kid. And I was ready to go. Man, I even had a little sample prayer in case they called on me to close the service. Sunday morning came. And, of course, we didn't have any clocks, so I didn't know exactly what time it was, but the sun was up, and so I figured, well, it must be, 7 or 8 o'clock. And I waited, and it got to what I thought was maybe 9 or 10 o'clock, and I waited. And got to 11 o'clock, and I waited. And finally, about noon, it seemed, I heard all the way down in the far end of the cell block, five coughs. Suddenly occurred to me we were going to have church. Because that meant that the cell block was clear of any of the guards. And so we all got on our knees in each one of those cells, and we prayed together. Maybe we had to stretch that one in the Bible about when two or three are gathered in His name that we weren't exactly face to face, but we felt that the Lord was there. And then every Sunday morning, we would pledge our allegiance to our flag. And sometimes it was just imaginary. Sometimes it was just the bars, you know, to pretend they were the stripes, and an old wasp nest in the corner might be the field of stars. But we pledged our allegiance to our flag and to our country. And maybe some of the closest communication that we ever had was that we knew churches like this were right back here praying for us on those Sunday mornings just as well. And that was the first church service. That was my introduction to church in a prison camp. Things got better after a while, and I got a roommate, and then another, and then he took those guys away, and I was alone. And at one time, after a raid on the prison camp, they called the Sante Raid. Some of you remember the special forces went in, raided an empty camp. But because of that, we were put into a large prison camp, the Hanoi Hilton. And we had 53 guys in a cell that was 30 feet long and 20 feet wide. We each had 14 inches of bed space, I remember. Whenever you wanted to roll over, you had to holler at everybody else and wake everybody else because you had to roll over in unison or it didn't work. But we were together for the first time. And I was selected as chaplain of that unit just because of my experiences with the Officers Christian Union back at the Naval Academy. So I set up a little church. And it was really interesting because of all these guys, there were only three that didn't want to come to my service. And they said, "Well, hey, Charlie, you know, we don't really believe in that stuff. And so, hey, we'll just do something else. In fact, we'll even watch through the crack in the door and make sure you don't get caught, but just don't include us." So I started a church service. And we had a makeshift altar, and we had a cross with a couple of sticks of bamboo, and we had some rags there as best we could, because it was totally forbidden against the camp regulations to have any kind, any evidence at all of anything religious. And so every Sunday morning when the yard was clear, like, we would set up our little church, and we would remember all the Bible verses, and it was really kind of neat. And as things got better and better, it seemed like the torture was over. This is about 3 years after I was there, and the torture seemed to end. We decided we want more than this. We'd like to have a Bible. We'd like to have a real church service on Sunday morning. So we organized, and we decided we're going to go on a hunger strike. We're going to give up back the rice. We're going to give back the pumpkin soup. And we're not going to eat until we can have a Bible, a real Bible, and until we can have the time to have a church service. Well, the North Vietnamese countered this by cutting off our water supply. Now, I can tell you from experience, you can live a long time without pumpkin soup. But you don't go very far without H2O. And about the third or fourth day, we were really getting thirsty. And then, almost like a miracle, we found a little hole in the wall, and we burrowed it out a little bit and threw to the other side in the cell next to us. And those guys weren't on a hunger strike, and so we passed a little tar paper tube through there, and they poured half their ration of water into that tube, and we caught the drops on the other side. And so we were going to survive, and we did. And the enemy came in. It was really interesting because of our senior people, the first two guys were very devout Christians. The third guy turned out to be a Jew. And they hauled the first guy out, put him in the stockades, the second guy too, and the Jew came along, and everybody was kind of wondering, does this guy really want a Bible or what? Is he really going to get beaten up for this? And he said, "No, we will continue to refuse to eat till you bring us a Bible." So they hauled him out of there, and two more guys, and finally they gave in. And they brought us a Bible, and they gave it to us for a day and a half. And we copied from two sides of a page all through the night on pieces of toilet paper, with a pen made from ink made from brick dust and ashes, and a pen made from bamboo, because it was that vital that we had those scriptures. But the real interesting part was that I was a chaplain, so I was in charge of the Bible. And I had a long line of guys, when I first got this Bible, just wanted to come up and touch it. And my three atheist buddies were on the front of the line. Well, we found that our belief really kept us going. Our faith in our God was what really put it all together. But everything else was gone, and you didn't have anything to stand on at all. You found We found comfort and grace in Jesus Christ. And we found comfort in prayer. And we never let that go. But you know what? It was kind of interesting because we recognized that it was this possibility of being a foxhole Christian. Have you heard that term? In most wars, you think, well, you know, a guy is just going to get Christianity while he's in trouble. And we thought a lot about that. We talked a lot about that because we felt that the worst thing we could do was suddenly be Christian and then when we were released, like, turn it all back. And we continued to pack those parachutes, and maybe the greatest parachute pack in the place turned out to be a sailor, a Navy sailor. This guy was the lowest ranking guy there. Because we were all officers. We were pilots, and pilots were being shot down. It was an air war. We were being blown out of the sky and parachuting into enemy hands. And so we had 200 top guns, and who shows up? A Navy sailor? How, you're asking, did a Navy sailor get into a prison camp in an air war over North Vietnam? He fell off his ship. He used to tell us, I wasn't captured. He'd say, I was rescued. 19 years old, on a cruiser, in the middle of the night, falls off. We'd have these contests. In our secret code, we'd tug on the wires, pass around a little questionnaire. We'd say, who's the oldest in the prison camp? We'd say, who's got the most kids back home? We'd say, who's been here the longest? One time, we had what we call the high, fast, low, slow contest to try to determine what fighter pilot had jumped out of his jet going highest and fastest, who jumped out going lowest and slowest. Well, high-fast contest is won by some Air Force jock who punched out of his F-105 at 52,000 feet, 1,000 miles an hour. Low-slow contest is won by the Navy sailor. 12 feet at 15 knots. Oh, here's the interesting part, and why I take the time to tell you this kid's story. You see, this lowly sailor, this insignificant entry-level, minimum wage, non-person person, you know the type we have to rub elbows with once in a while, but we don't like to very much. The guy didn't suffer from prison thinking the way the more mature officer class did. I don't know why. I can't explain this to you. Sometimes I think, well, he just wasn't mature enough to understand the problem. You know, you're not born with prison thinking. That is an acquired trait. That's a characteristic that we learn. You're not born blaming your mother for your pain, playing the role of an infant. That just comes, and he didn't get it. He didn't seem to stack in these prison blocks, you know, the blocks that we all get around us once in a while. He didn't have a block for anger and one for guilt and one for jealousy and one for revenge. And he didn't stack those things up higher than he could see. What did the sailor do? The sailor set to work. The sailor got into action. The sailor decided, as bad as this looks, there's some value here, and I'm going to find out what it is. The sailor kicked down what was left of his comfort zone. He started taking risks. He started tugging on wires. He collected all the names of all the prisoners. 200 of us, first, middle, last name. He put our names in the songs. He would sing these songs over and over. Went back through the list. He memorized our social security number or identifier, 200 different numbers. Incredible. Still wasn't finished. Went back through the list. He memorized our hometowns all across the country. Then he memorized our next of kin, wives and fathers. And finally, I'm not kidding, the sailor memorized the telephone numbers of each of the relatives of each of the prisoners. Now, that took 2 years. He was 21. And that year, the enemy came up with a little promotion deal. They're going to send some guys home early before the end of the war. Our senior man sent the message to the sailor. Said, son, I want you to volunteer to go home first. What do you suppose he said? Remember, this is a parachute packer. This is the kind of a person you'd like to have on your elbow when you face the real tough ones. The sailor sent back, sir, with all due respect, I'd rather stay here with the team. The problem's not finished, and I want to be a part of the solution. Our senior man sent back, that's not an option. Here's a direct order, shove off. And the sailor said, aye, aye, sir. And home he came. Now write the script on this sailor. Write the, what could you expect of this guy now? 2 years in prison by accident. He's been starved, lonely, humiliated, but things are looking up. He now has a brand new suit of clothes on, 2 years back pay in his pocket, and he's free on the streets of San Diego. What can you expect? Oh, but he was a parachute packer.
Now, what do you suppose he did? The kid went west coast to east. He went north to south. He went through each one of the hometowns he'd memorized. He dialed each one of those telephone numbers he'd memorized. He spoke to each one of the wives he'd memorized and told her that her prisoner was alive. Let me ask you this. You know any of those people I'm talking about, those parachute packers? People that give without asking anything in return, that aren't interested in the immediate gratification or the quick fix or the kudos or the accolades. Yeah, these pews are full of them. Look to your right, look to your left. You'll see a bunch of parachute packers in here. You couldn't have this great church without those kinds of giving, loving Christians. And they're in your families. I thought about my wife a lot. The lady I had married under the arch of swords. I would fast forward my mind about an hour a day just to be with her. And I had the next 20 years planned around her. I had 20 years of birthdays. I had her birthday figured out for 20 years. I had the presents and the packages and the wrappings and everything. I had Christmases figured out. I had meals. I had figured out 3 meals a day for 20 years. And I had some doozies. I had steak and lobster. I had pheasant under glass. I had no rice. The day finally came. We were told we were going home. Here's how it happened. In came the rat. We didn't like the rat. This was the camp commander. He'd been in charge of all of our torture. And the rat opened the cell door wider than ever been opened before, and he tried to smile. First time we'd ever seen the rat smile. And there were several of us in that little cell, and he announced, "Today's the day you're going home. Get on the bus. It's outside the gate." And nobody moved. Nobody cried. Nobody cheered. Nobody hugged and kissed anyone else. I'm wondering, this is the day we've been praying for. This is the word we've been hoping for, and it's here, and nobody's showing any emotion. We all sat real still, said a little prayer. Our senior man stood up, skinny guy, Jim Peary from 8 Mile, Alabama. And he faced the camp commander, and as we had been forced to do all those years, he made a very low, ceremonious bow, and then he squared his jaw, and Peary said, "Sir, we're not going home until all the sick and injured men have left this camp." And he was serious. And the rat couldn't understand that. And the rat said, "Wait a minute, you don't understand my English. I'm offering you your freedom." I'll never forget our senior guy's words. They ring in my ears like this was yesterday. He said, "Sir, freedom is vital to us, but not without our integrity." And the camp commander hauled him out of there and put him in the stockade, rice and water, and bloodied him up pretty good. And the camp commander came back to the rest of us, the rest of the junior officers that were left. And the rat said, "Your senior guy will be punished, but the rest of you can go home if you'll get on the bus outside the gate." Now, we didn't know what to do. You see, we're a bunch of junior officers, and our senior guy just left, and we didn't know what to do. What do you do when you don't know what to do? Have a meeting. And that's exactly what we did. We had a little huddle right there in the prison camp. You know what we decided? We decided, nobody's ever going to believe this. This is so preposterous. The whole idea that we would give up this ticket home for some kind of a fuzzy principle. We knew how unpopular the Vietnam War was. We knew there were people parading in the streets, bring the boys home. We knew if it took a poll of all Americans in one unanimous voice, they would say, "Get out of there, you guys. What are you standing on some kind of principle or what?" But we can't go. We can't leave the guys here that are sick and injured. I'll tell you, it was scary saying that. We didn't know if that would, put us in the front of a firing squad or what. But it sure felt good to have that kind of control, that kind of power. The rat slammed that cell door closed. We didn't know if it ever opened again. He marched up to the head shed, yelling all the way. He came back about an hour later with a printout, a computerized sheet signed at the bottom by an ambassador. It was the manifest, the first plane load of guys. It was also our prayer list, the sick and injured. They had gone. Now it was our turn. Still no rest for the bus. They put our senior guy back with us, and he called us to attention outside that prison cell, and he called cadence up 2, 3, 4,
as we marched out of there, proud Americans with our heads held high, going home. On the bus, over the dike, from the top of the dike, we could see the runway. And on the end of the enemy's runway, a United States Air Force C-141, ready to wing us away to freedom. What a sight that was. What a lump in my throat. But still no response. Nobody cried. Nobody cheered. Nobody hugged and kissed anyone else. I kept waiting and wondering, when are we going to bust loose and realize we're going home? Do you know, it wasn't until we climbed aboard that airplane. It wasn't until we rolled down that runway. It wasn't really till we finally lifted off enemy soil. We all broke loose and started hugging and kissing the Air Force nurses. <laughs> 90 minutes later, I was putting these feet on free soil, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. And some of you remember the TV coverage on that, watching us come down those ladders. And I ran across that tarmac to the first phone I could find to call. Tell her the good news. And I had that first conversation totally memorized. You would have too. I had spent hundreds of hours rehearsing that first phone call. I had selected every word. I knew the emphasis on every sentence I was going to say. Honey, it's really been tough on you. Tougher on you than it's been on me. I was going to say, but it's over now, don't you see? We're going to be better off. We're going to be a tighter couple because of the experience we have faced together. I was going to say, we've been through hell, but we've done it together, and now we're going to boogie tonight. And she had gone. And I called my folks back in Kansas, and I said, what's happened to my wife? And they said, she hung on for 5 years, and then just 3 months ago, your wife filed for divorce. She's engaged to another guy. Boy, is that life for you or what? I mean, I thought this was going to have a happy ending, Charlie. Does that happen to you just about the time things are looking up? You know, you're going to get that promotion, that get that new house, that new car. About the time you have one of those mountaintop experiences is over the ledge and down the other side. Now, Charlie Plum, show me some value in this crisis. And I'm talking to myself and I'm saying, I don't know what happened in the good old USA. I didn't learn much over there in that prison camp, but if I got a degree in anything, it's hard knocks. And if, in fact, I can piece together this jigsaw puzzle, if I can apply the things that I learned in that 8-foot by 8-foot classroom of crisis, maybe it'll work. Spent a couple of days with Connie Chung here a few years ago. She did a deal on network on my life and my philosophy. Kind of glad she didn't interview my mom. My mother wouldn't use words like that, I don't think. But it was really interesting. You know, just the course of the days and the final interview, last interview. Lights, action, camera, you know. She said, Charlie, I've been following you around here for 2 days. I think I know you pretty well. She said, I've read your books and I've seen your videotapes and I had pancakes with your little kids in your kitchen this morning. And she did. She said, I had one final question. Are you always so happy about life? I mean, what about these wild nightmares we hear about these Vietnam veterans? What about the thoughts of suicide? What about this post-traumatic stress disorder? I said, well, Connie, you know, I heard of that, but I decided not to participate. She said, aren't you ever depressed? I said, no. She said, that's depressing. I then shared with Connie Chung, as I will share with this family gathered here, gang, I have my frustrations in life just like everybody else. I have kids that scream at night, cars that don't start in the morning. I have airplanes that leave without me, but I have one advantage nobody in this congregation has. I listen to this speech 3 times a week. When I get out there in the highways and byways of life, and I've had one of those kind of days, and I'm trying to make it home to my wife and kids, and nothing's going right. Now that airplane left without me, and it's not fair, and I'm pounding on some ticket counter and blaming some agent. It's a victim of circumstances beyond my... Wait a minute, you hypocrite. You're going to tell those fine people it's going to be their choice, even in challenging times, and now you're acting like this? Come on, Charlie, grab your socks, tuck in your gut, get on getting on, so you see it works in my life like it works in yours. We've done pretty well, the POWs. We're setting records, you know. I'm so proud of our group. 591 guys, that's all who came home, 591. And they thought we would be in baskets. They thought we'd be vegetables. They had our families briefed to institutionalize us for the rest of our lives. So far, we've produced 27 admirals or generals in the military. That's a record. No group in history has ever done that. We've produced 2 United States senators. Again, a record. A bunch of congressmen, doctors, lawyers, preachers, teachers, bishops, judges, mayors, you name it, we got it. Now, the medical community tells us that we're healthier today, mentally and physically, than if we hadn't been shot down. Figure that out. And the guys who were there the longest seem to have come back the healthiest. How's that for validating this principle of being blown out of the sky can be beneficial once in a while? How's that for this principle of when you're reduced to the very basis of life, you find out the true meaning of life? How's that for validating this philosophy that when everything else is gone, when you can't hold on to your nice car, your nice clothes, your nice home, or your job title, when everything else is gone, the only thing that's really meaningful is the thing that you thought was so elusive? It's your faith. Shoemaker on the end of the wire, 2-star admiral today. Doug Hegel, the kid that memorized the names, he's a teacher. My co-pilot came back to the States, went back to flying Navy jets. Now, some guys never learn. My ex-wife married the guy she was engaged to. They're living happily ever after in Kansas, and we married a wonderful lady in Memphis, Tennessee, and we have a 9-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy. We live in Santa Barbara, California. You say, that's an interesting story, Charlie. What's it got to do with me? I'll never be a prisoner of war. I'll never have to know the codes and pace the pace, and I hope and pray that none of you ever get into a scrape like this. But don't you see the connection? You'll have those challenges. They're coming. You'll have those days when you feel cut off from your support group, unable to communicate with those you love the most, inadequate for the new task, under siege by those who represent you. And when you have those feelings, if you can really believe that there's some value here and then get outside yourself, kick down what's left of your comfort zone, apply the faith and the commitment and the courage and the pride, it works in your life like it works in mine. In closing, let's take one more trip back to this little cell. I'd like for you to come with me and imagine yourself on a cold, rainy night, 10,000 miles away from home. And you don't even know if anybody's back here waiting for you anymore. And you're hungry and you're tired and you're hurting. And just about the time when you think all hope is gone, you hear in the far corner of the cell block a misty voice. It seems like a guy is singing, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." And as you listen, the other side of the cell block, another man joins in. And soon, all the prisoners come to the doors and they begin to sing together. And the whole cell block seems to erupt in this great, great effort of faithfulness to our God. Will you sing with me? Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. Thank you very much. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Is your parachute packed? Are you ready to meet Jesus? If not, who's packing your parachute? Charlie Plum had thought of the many hours the sailor had spent at the long wooden table in the bowels of the ship, carefully weaving the shrouds and folding the silks of each parachute, holding in his hands each time the fate of someone he didn't know. who's packing your chute. We invite you to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior. Give your life to Jesus today. If you'd like to receive Jesus, repeat after me. Jesus, I come to you a sinner, confessing my need for you. I cannot save myself. I need you. Thank you for the forgiveness of sins from your work on the cross. And we praise you for my salvation now. In Jesus' name, amen.
As with any new teaching, a one-time review of this message is not enough. We encourage you to listen to this recording again and again to get everything out of it that God wants you to receive. We pray that if you think of others who would benefit from this message, that you would make copies of it and share it with them. Take the time to make a difference in someone's life today. For more personal testimonies and Bible teaching messages, or to request a tape or CD catalog, please contact Firefighters for Christ at firefighters.org. That's FIREFIGHTERS.ORG. Or call branch number 1 at 949-470-9883. That's firefighters.org. Or call branch 1 at 949-470-9883. 8-3.